And we're back with float tube fly fisherman Bob Bracey. And Bob, we were discussing the different float tubes that are out there, the round inner tube type float tube, the U-tube float tube, and there are some others, right? There are the rowing tubes.
They even make them quite a bit bigger than that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a guess at possibly 6 feet long by 4 feet wide,
right,
with little pontoon-like
yes
devices on them, which keeps you up out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
For me, they're a little too big. I like to hike into ponds and different places, and
right,
I suppose you could hike one in, but
mm-hmm,
I like them, but it's too big for me. Some
yeah
guys really like them,
yep,
and they can cover a lot of water with
sure
them. They can fish bigger bodies of
right
water. Some have oars on them that you can paddle yourself
right
with oars. I prefer the smaller.
Right.
Yeah, they make one that's a packable one, but you're still talking, I think, upwards of 40, 50 pounds or something like that you have to haul in.
Right, right, yeah. And that might not be too bad for some folks getting into some of these remote ponds, Norm.
Right.
They're quite a bit more expensive, I think,
right,
the
right
ones with the floats and the oars, yeah, and like a lot more expensive.
The one I have now, I mean, the inner tube type, is they're less than $100 now.
My U-boat was $78,
$78.
Okay,
yep,
brand new.
Right, right.
You can't beat it, in,
yep,
in my opinion. You got a boat.
Yep.
And they last for years
right
if you yeah take care of them,
exactly,
which I don't. But so I buy one every 2 years. But they will last for
right
years and year, 10
yep
years, 15 years.
I've had mine for about 15
yeah
years.
Yeah, they'll last a long
I've got,
time.
I've got two of them. And you can put a little pack frame on them, just some shoulder straps, and do it that way. Or, you know, we just carry them with one hand. Sometimes we put them up on top of our head and go. Right.
My best fishing buddy, okay, we fished for 30, 40 years. He's a guide. He's been guiding people in float tubes for probably 15 or 20 years. He does probably as much in the tubes as he does in the boats.
Right.
Depends on what they want.
Yeah.
Sometimes people new in a float tube have it takes them a little bit, not long, 10, 15, 20 minutes,
right,
half hour, to get the feel for it, but
mm-hmm
they love them once they're in
right
it. You're so close to the water. You can catch fish in your hands once you're getting ready to bring the fish to the float.
Right.
It's like it's in your face, okay,
yeah,
versus leaning over a boat.
Right,
or,
right.
No, I love them.
And just to be honest with everybody, when we get in the float tubes, we have fins on. So we're kicking ourselves along there. And I mean, we're getting exercise while we're out there.
Very good exercise. I have a friend that's a mountain climber, and he float tubes when he's not climbing mountains because it works different muscles than when he's climbing.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that it evens everything out for him, so it's like another workout.
Right.
My legs, for my age, are really strong.
Yeah,
and
yeah
it's float tube, right?
Right.
Between
hiking and then the
hiking,
paddling.
Hiking and float tube. You also have to have waders in the float tube.
Right.
Early in the year, you'd freeze to death. You couldn't handle it.
Right,
even
right
with waders in
yep
the ice out, it's real cold. But
that's cold.
We do it.
We're out there in April.
And
the water temperature's 40,
I have fished
degrees.
March 15th. Bill and I
have
fished.
Have you really?
March 15th.
You were out there that early.
And we caught over 50 brook trout
wow
in about 2 hours. They were hungry.
And I know you're telling the truth because I know how well you do out there.
I'm just saying that. They're hungry, okay? They're
yep
hungry if you can get at them.
Right.
And we just walked in with a float tube. And
right.
It was unreal.
That's
we
fantastic
took a friend who'd never been in one, and he bought one the next day.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, they people, once they've done it, they get hooked on it for sure. Lightweight, safe. I do put on a little life jacket.
And I like that.
Yeah.
I do.
They're lightweight. You can put on, you know, a bigger life jacket if you want to. Depending on the time of the year, I might put on something a little thicker when it's
correct
cooler. Because we're out there, like I said, I've been out there in April, and water temperature's in the 40s. I'm
right
wearing 5 mil waders on,
right,
plus long johns and pants, just to make sure that I'm warm enough.
I'm going to say, just as an off guess, that you could get started with a float tube. The flippers usually come with the tube when
yep
you buy them.
Right.
And waders for probably $200 to $300, and I mean, you could get a good one.
Right, yeah.
And you could be fishing the next day.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah,
fishing on your own.
And we talked about, Bob, this before off air, that the fish aren't, they're not afraid of people in float tubes. I mean, we get fish come right up to the tube and bite our fly.
I've had fish closer than the length of my rod tip.
Right.
It, it, I, I'm amazed. I think they're more afraid of a boat or a canoe than the float tube.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems weird that your half of your body's hanging in the water.
Right.
It doesn't seem to bother. I've had fish honestly hit my leg before.
Yep.
Not a lot, but some.
Yep. So they're comfortable, lightweight, non-intimidating to the fish, great for hiking into remote locations. And you're getting some active exercise out there, and it feels like you're in an easy chair. I love fishing out of the float tube.
They have different designs, and like, is yours like U shape?
Mine is the U shape, and for an older person, less stable. I'm not meaning it in a bad way, but it's so much easier to step back in, just walk into it and sit down and put a gate over the top.
Yeah, right.
With the inner tube type, you have to step up into them, and if your flippers are on, which most guys do,
right,
it's hard to get in. If you try to get them on afterwards, it's almost impossible.
See, my experience has been like, I've got one that, like bow shaped. You know, it's not U, pointed in more than anything else, and I'd have to say that if I bought another float tube, it would be the U-shape.
The U-shape.
Because I found that bow shape was just not as... I felt like if I was sitting too far back in it, it wasn't comfortable at all.
Right.
And I had to sit closer to the edge, which at the time I was like, how close do I want to be to this edge? So,
yeah.
I've been in those. I don't... Yeah, I know what you're saying. You feel crowded as well.
Yep.
They make different size float tubes as well. You can buy them for up to 300 pounds, right? A 300 pound man, which they're a size bigger.
Okay.
And it's much roomier in there.
Sure.
So, I mean, honestly, the sky's the limit. You get online and look around, and it's amazing, really.
Sure. Yeah. So, your approach to fishing a new pond, Bob, when you hike in for the first time with your float tube and you're, you know, looking to fish for trout, just take us through what you usually do.
Well, I usually try to get some info before I go.
Like depth?
Depth. I'll go on your site, the main site, and get map lake surveys. You can find out a lot just from that, okay?
Yep.
What's in there, how deep, this, that. But if I can't do that, or even when I do that, I go to a body of water. From years of fishing experience, I look at where the land meets the water, okay?
Yeah.
Whatever's happening is going to continue on into the body of water.
Right.
If there's a big ridge, a cliff, a flat, or a drop-off, and you can almost look at it and figure out spots to try to fish to start.
Right.
And you start fishing and work it over, okay?
Yep.
You learn. I do. Every time I go, I learn a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at the area, and then I take what's in the bank up here from what little I remember and put it to use, okay?
Sure.
And hope they're biting, all right, Greg?
Yeah, that's right. That's right, because they don't bite all the time.
They don't.
As you know, we've discussed these bright bluebird days, high pressure. Sometimes the fish just don't bite on those days. You know, dark, overcast sky. I know that you are a firm believer when it's dark and a little stormy out there, then, boy, the fish are usually on.
I have a lot better luck on cloudy, drizzly.
Yeah.
The old timers would call them a soft day, okay?
Yeah.
So it's just light. There's no big storm.
Right.
And I don't have very good luck on sunny days.
Yep.
I think they can see too good.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't fool him anywhere near as good.
Right, right.
So, but what do I know?
No, I think you're right. You've had a lot of years of experience. I think you're right. Now, sometimes I've seen you out there with your depth finder.
I have taken a fish finder, correct, portable, and put it on the side of my best friend does it too. He swears by it. Fish finder. Mm-hmm. They drive me crazy.
Yep.
But no, you can set it right on the side of your float tube and put your transducer over the side.
Yep.
It drives me crazy, but it works really good, okay?
Good.
It's in the way for me, but
it's
very, you can do it.
Right.
A lot of guys do.
Sure.
And you can really figure out a body of water then.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
So some of the good flies that you like, Bob, and you've told me, hey, if there's a good fly in one water, it usually works in another. Mickey Finn early and late. Early in the season and late in the season, right?
If I had one to pick early, it would be the Mickey Finn, okay?
Yep.
And
yep.
late as well.
Yep. yep.
Better early.
They like those colorful flies real early in the season, and then in the fall, they like those colorful flies
again.
They do.
During the summer, that Mickey Finn, leave it home.
Right, right.
I'm just saying for me, okay?
Sure.
But for a month in the spring and a month in the fall is deadly.
Right.
There's a few other flies, too, that I'm a fly tire, and my friends are, so we come up with our own patterns, and we would personally rather catch fish on those than the traditional patterns, but trust me, we use traditional patterns.
Yeah.
Whatever they want, we're going to give them.
And you have a saying, the fly that you catch the most fish on is the what?
The one you fish the most.
That's right.
Okay.
That's
it's as simple as that. Everybody's got their own fly, okay?
Right.
Everybody.
Yep. Yeah, and yeah. Norm, too. He likes it.
And it's different from mine. Yeah.
And Paul's is the hornbird.
Okay. He likes that one.
Yes,
right?
He does.
Yep. And I know that Bob Lehman, he likes that marabou muddler.
Yes, he does.
He fishes that one.
Yeah, yep, very
religiously.
Much so.
Yep. Now, when you go into a pond, Bob, and you see surface activity, I mean, the fish are coming up. They may be going for something very specific, and you might not be able to catch them on just anything.
All I can say to that is good luck. If this specific,
right.
And it's usually on a hatch of insects, right. Mayflies, caddis, whatever, all the hatches.
Yep.
If my experience is if you don't have almost exactly what they're feeding on,
right.
If there's a big hatch,
yep.
I've been with you and done it. They won't,
right.
You might as well not fish.
Sure, sure.
But we do.
Yeah. And, you know, and that can be that situation and the novice fly fishermen, they can be the most intimidating when because that's what they think happens all the time is that you have to have the right fly. We're going to go to a break right now and we'll be right back after these important messages. And we're back, and we have Bob Bracey, float tube fly fisherman, with us. I just want to finish up with Bob here before we get to our next guest, Randy Cross, who's on the line with us. Bob, there's these hanging flies that people are using now. My wife and I were just recently in Scotland, and that's a very popular way of catching fish over there. Maybe you can talk a little bit about those.
It is, Greg, and I just learned about it a couple of years ago from a friend of mine who is very interested in the way they fish over in Scotland and England and all over in that area. So he's done a lot of research on it. He does fish that way some. They use little small float bobbers that are made out of usually foam. They're very light. Some of them are breakaway bobbers. You slide it over your line, and when you set the hook on a fish, it loosens and it comes free, and you just you're fighting the fish. A lot of the insects that we talk about that hatch from the bottom and rise to the surface are going vertical, okay? They're going straight up.
Right.
And they might not be straight, but they're going up all the time.
Right.
They don't go back down. They,
mm-hmm.
they could, but... So in order to get a proper presentation of these chironomidges, mayfly, a lot of different bugs, if you hang them off of a float straight down, they look like they're going straight up.
Right.
And it looks normal. I've fished a lot of small nymphs with sinking line or even floating line, not hanging.
Right.
It doesn't work very good.
Mm.
I'm just in the process of myself of starting to fish that way. So I have high hopes of doing well. I know that they do real well.
I had an angler call me the other day, and he said he had been fishing over northwest Canada. They were fishing for large rainbows, and they were using that technique, and they were catching 5 and 6 pound rainbows. He said it was unbelievable. He said it works very, very well.
I have a good friend that catches rainbows that way, big rainbows. Can't catch them any other way either, so. Nope,
that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, we're going to get to Randy. Thank you, Bob. Randy Cross, you on the line?
Yes, I am.
How you doing, Randy? Thank you for calling in.
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Greg.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So our bear season is almost upon us. People are out there baiting right now. And how's the natural food supply for bears this summer, Randy?
It's compared to last year, it's much lower availability, and bears are much more active this year than they were last fall.
So there's not a lot of berries, fruits out there that are available for the bears now?
Well, it's, you know, we're right in the peak of the berry season, so there's berries out there, but it's just a more widespread, smaller berries, harder to forage on than they were last year.
Mm-hmm.
And their diet's so complex, and they eat so many different berries that they, you know, it's a little bit of always a complicated situation,
right.
But yeah, they're a little hungrier this year than they were last okay. year.
I've talked to a couple of guides already, and they've got their baits out, and they said they're getting hit very, very regularly. So they're pretty excited that this is going to be a successful bear season.
Yeah, it's going to be really good for the bait hunters. The downside is very likely kind of slow at the tail end of the season because of early den entry.
Right, right. Okay, because they haven't gotten as much food, they'll enter the den early.
Right. And we don't expect a lot of late season. Acorns and beech nuts are the two that usually keep them out more than anything else.
Right.
The only other thing might be mountain ash berries that might hold them out a little okay. longer this year, but the other two probably not going to be there.
Okay. So even though, Randy, that, you know, it may stay warmer later in through the fall, if the food's not there, the bears will still den up early?
That's correct. It's strange as it sounds, prolonged warm weather in late fall will drive them into the dens because they have the winter coat on, they have
right.
some of the winter fat already accumulated,
right.
so hard for them to forage when it gets really warm. They
gotcha.
May be only able to forage for a few hours each night.
Sure. Okay, that's something we don't think about. Yeah, for sure. Okay. That makes sense. So how's the bear population in Maine? Is it stable? Is it increasing, Randy?
It's been on a slow increase for a little over 10 years now. It's our best estimate is it's a increasing at about 2 to 4%, probably closer to the 2%. But,
okay.
Steady increase, slow.
Are you seeing sows with multiple cubs now, more and more, you know, triplets, quadruplets, you know, things like that?
I don't see a really big difference in productivity, really, to tell you the truth. Our cub survival has been a little higher. The productivity has been fairly stable. You know, you do see changes from year to year. Just for instance, this last winter, we saw more losses, cub litter losses, whole litter losses to flooding because of the floods that occurred right around January 10th, particularly down east.
I see. Interesting. Do you attribute that to maybe some warmer winters that we're having, Randy? There's just, you know, more melting going on, that type of thing?
It could be tied into that sort of climate change thing, but it's, you know, it just changes the odds perhaps, because really it's just a gamble of when. It's pretty random, but when that flood occurs,
okay.
it occurs right when the cubs are being born, which January 10th is like the worst possible time for the water to come up, because that's just about where most of your cubs are born, right one
okay.
side or the other of that.
I see. Right around January 10th. Okay. So tell me what happens when the department gets a report of a nuisance bear. How is that handled, Randy?
Generally, the warden service is involved as the point person. Whatever the district warden is, will investigate the issue. And most times, there's some attraction there, some food reward for the bear
mm-hmm.
that, whether it's inadvertent, usually a bird feeder or garbage that's not secured.
Right.
That will, you know, a lot of times take care of your problem if you remove that food attraction.
Gotcha.
So that's where they would tackle most problems from yep. The human side of it, and the bear will more likely than not move on if there's nothing there for them.
So I would imagine we would tell people who have a grill to empty out their grease pan regularly, because that could be
yep.
an attractant to bears as well. That's something that
anything
maybe...
Anything like that.
Anything like that.
You know, pet food needs to be secured indoors.
Right.
Any sort of food that a bear can get on a year like this. If you're living in bear country, you've probably already done a lot of that.
Right.
But a lot of people live in places where there's still some potential for a bear to find this food bonanza, because, you know, it's there and it's just waiting for a bear to find it.
Right, gotcha.
So there's a lot of the state where we have fairly low density of bears. Quite a few people live in that part of the state.
Right.
And the risk isn't that high overall, but it's still a risk there that a bear will come and find that.
Sure, sure. What about blueberry growers? Do they have a lot of problems with, you know, bears coming into their crop, or is it mostly just bears going for their hives?
They have more problems with damage to their beehives, and they do try to protect their beehives, but commercial growers use a lot of beehives, and it's a lot of sandy soil, and it can be difficult to get their electric fences grounded well, and
right.
Bears can often dig under the fence mm-hmm. because the sand's so soft, so they have a lot of problems with that. A beehive, I believe, is now worth somewhere around $300 if they ruin the hive. So in one night, they can cause quite a bit of damage really quickly.
Sure.
As far as I know, they don't worry nearly as much about incidental take of the fruit itself.
Yep.
I think there's just so much of it. And there's so many other animals, a lot of animals that take part in some of that surplus berries that are there.
Sure, sure. So when there is a nuisance bear, Randy, you say the district warden is the point person. You know, who makes the decision where you would say you talk to the landowner, the homeowner, and say, hey, look, the department can't take care of this, but if you call this animal damage control person, that they'll come and trap the bear, and the homeowner, the landowner has to pay that person? Is that the way it works?
Yeah, that's the way it works, and it's not cheap. It's way more expensive than catching a skunk or a raccoon and moving it
sure.
a shorter distance. But it's not the solution that we recommend in most cases. It's just a sort of a Band-Aid approach in most situations. Every situation is different. There
right.
are times when that works well, but it's fairly short term in general. Either the bear that you moved could very likely come back, or the next bear finds the same problem. So
right.
if you don't take care of the root of the problem, usually it's a non-permanent fix.
Right, right. Know? So you got to remove that food source. That's the biggest thing.
Right.
Yep.
Bears just going to do what bears do and try to find the best reward for his efforts.
Sure.
And if you leave rewards there, he's going to come back and take advantage of it again, or the next bear comes along and does the same thing.
Right,
so
right.
You really have to take care of the problem
yep.
at the root of the problem.
Yep, gotcha. Well, Randy, please stay on the line. We're going to just cut for a break here for a few minutes. We want to talk about one of our very important sponsors, General Appliance in Center Street in Brewer. Go down and see Al Alkin. They've got every type of appliance you would want down there. They have the new compost toilets.
Ride the wave, baby.
Ride the wave. That's right, Jim. No running water, no plumbing issues, no septic and no leach field problems, environmental issues, no lurk permitting. There they are, the advanced technology, and people just love those. But Al's got all kinds of different appliances down there. Sue and I went and bought a nice gas stove from Al for our hunting camp, and it's just terrific. And the service after the sale is wonderful. People just love going in and talking to Al. He's quite a character, and he really takes care of his customers. Anybody that comes in to see him, and his appliances are top rate. So go down and see Al and give him a call, 989-3714. That's That's General Appliance on Stenner Street in Brewer, 989-3714. All right, we'll get back to Randy Cross. Now, Randy, the bear season starts at what date this year? Where you can start hunting?
3 weeks from yesterday would be the youth hunting day for bait.
Okay.
That's the 25th. And 3 weeks from tomorrow will be the general open season for bait hunters for okay. for all adult bait hunters.
So that'd be the 27th of August. All right. And
yep.
So it should
Monday in August.
Yep. So it should be a great season. Sounds like there's a lot of bears out there, and there's a lot of hungry bears out there. And we get back to a little bit about the nuisance bears. You know, if folks really don't want to have that problem happening, of course, like you say, remove that that food source, but also to really support hunters out there, people who want to harvest this free-ranging, healthy meat out there and keep the bear population in check. Is that what the department is saying?
That's correct. We rely on the bear hunters to remove the surplus that's produced every year.
Right.
And the important part about that is trying to keep the bears at a level that's healthy for them and more likely that they'll be able to find all the food they need in the wild and not have to be kind of forced to take risks and come
right.
to towns to feed and so forth.
Exactly, exactly. Now, after the bear baiting season ends, then you have hunters that want to hunt with dogs. What date does that start, Randy?
That starts on September 10th, so
okay.
2 weeks of baiting.
Yep.
September 10th, the hounds start, and there's 2 weeks of overlap. So
okay.
4 weeks of baiting that
okay.
would end on the 22nd.
Right. All right. Now, if you're a bow hunter, Randy, come October 1st, you could take a bear with your bow. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, you can take a bear with the bow anytime during any of the seasons.
Right.
It's open to any, you know, crossbow, bow, pistols,
right.
rifles, shotguns. So.
Yeah. Do you have to have a special permit, you know, other than your bow hunting permit? I'm a bow hunter. I sometimes see a bear when I'm out there hunting for deer that I might like to harvest.
That one I'm not sure about. I know there was talk about it, but I'm not sure. So
okay.
I'm not the best person to ask.
Okay.
But,
all right. Okay. I'll certainly check.
To ask the game warden, no.
Okay. I'll certainly check into that. And the limit on bear is just one per person per year, correct?
Yes, unless it is sort of. Trapping season opens on Saturday, the 1st of September,
mm-hmm.
and runs through the month of October. So
okay.
it's two full months.
Yep.
You can take a second bear by use of a trap. So the trap, you take a bear by any method, and then a
okay.
second bear by trap.
By trap, okay.
Now, with all these methods, are you able to take out the numbers that you'd like annually? Or
we are still coming up a little bit short most years. I think this particular year we may get a lot closer to our harvest objective. I'm hopeful that we'll see a very, very good harvest this year. We'll see more, I'm positive, than we saw last year. Right now, we're trying to look at different opportunities to expand the harvest. It doesn't need to go great bounds, but it does. We would like to see a small number more each year by some way or another that we can allow people better opportunities to harvest a bear.
And is that something that the legislature would have to approve, Randy, or is that something that would go through the Commissioner's Advisory Council?
Most of what we could do is already been done. So, most would have to go through the legislature
okay.
For different expansions, different opportunities
sure.
that we could possibly expand.
Okay. I just have to go over this article that I read in the Bangor Daily over the weekend. You were quoted in there about this Nova Scotia Atlantic salmon fisherman on the Margaree River that had a black bear chase him across the salmon pool. You're familiar with that article?
Sure.
Yeah. So the bear charged him and was swimming across the pool after him. And the man ran to his car and made it to safety. But you folks advise, you and Jennifer Vachon advise, don't run, back away, unless you can get to a place quickly. Don't run. The bear attacks are very rare here in Maine, or rare in general, and very rare in Maine. But if you run from a bear, that will trigger a flight response. Is that what you folks are getting at?
Yeah, it's not recommended. It's not just something that Jen and I made up. It's
right.
It's we don't see our people faced with this situation very often. It is someone's got to think about how far they have to go to get to safety.
Right.
And that's the important thing. So if you're a mile in on some hiking trail and you get confronted by a bear, if you turn and run, it's been shown in many cases that that's not a good plan.
Right.
You're too far away from your vehicle. Bears can move very quickly, and often anything fleeing can trigger a predatory response from the bear.
Right.
If that bear had that kind of in his mind
right.
at all.
Right.
And most black bear attacks are predatory. So.
Right, right. And again, here in Maine, it's very rare that a bear would actually stalk a human. I mean, when I was in Alaska, they were telling us, you have to worry about the grizzlies a little bit, but you really have to worry about the black bears because they will stalk you and kill you. But here in Maine, that's a pretty rare occurrence. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. And I think that it is another thing that we owe to the bear hunters is that the bear hunters are continually taking out the most bold and aggressive bears from
right.
the population every fall.
Right, right. And bear complaints, I was reading in this article, you had 462 bear complaints. So far this year. Last year was 389, and the most bear complaints you had was in 2012 at 830.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Yep. 830 is the entire active season.
Right.
We're not quite there yet. So we'll probably end up just over 500, which isn't much over average, but slightly
yep.
above average.
Yep.
We don't see average years that much. Mostly we either have a very strong nuisance conflict year and followed by a weak conflict year. That's kind of a common pattern.
Sure. And what do you allow that to? Why does that happen?
Natural foods.
Just natural foods.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to get to some more of your and Jennifer's quotes in that article because I think they are very informative. Said that we have bears that will basically do anything they can, turn themselves inside out to get away from humans. I thought that was really good, a good quote
yeah.
there. So they,
that's
they,
a well-behaved bear.
Right,
bear
right.
They want to get away from you.
Yep.
That's what we want to see them do.
Yeah. I spend a lot of time in the outdoors with my work, as you know, and just out there hunting and fishing myself. And, you know, through my lifetime, I've only seen, you know, I can count them on two hands, the amount of bears I've seen. And I know I've been around them, but they sense that I'm there, and they're gone before I ever get a look at them.
Yeah, they're a lot better at figuring out where you are before you can figure out
right.
where they are.
That's right, exactly.
That's a good way to have it.
That's right, so. Exactly. So they're regularly hunted, and that's why they're so shy of humans. They're afraid of us because we do harvest them, and again, thank the hunters for that to keep them at bay. And you said in there, I think that aggressive bears are more common in places where they have less interactions with humans and are more common in areas where there is no hunting or limited hunting.
That's correct. And
yep.
that's kind of, you know, it kind of comes back to the human avoidance behavior. If they have a high level of human avoidance, they live a long time, produce a lot of cubs, pass that behavior on to their cubs. And if they don't pass the test, and they're tested every fall,
right,
of trying to stay away from human scent, then they're removed from the population. I mean, you do that for 300 years, and you end up with an animal that avoids people.
Right, right.
It has a population effect on the behavior.
Yep, and that's what you want, for sure.
That's what we want.
Yep, right. And he said, most people, this is another quote, most people don't see the difference between feeding and baiting, but there's a huge difference. When you're feeding bears, the most bold bears get the most rewards. And when you're baiting bears, the most bold bears get killed. Big difference. I thought that was an excellent quote, Randy.
Trying to break it down simply, you know, I remember during the referendum when fellow that was confused and said, it's the way I understand baiting, the hunter puts some bait in the woods, the bear comes and eats the bait, then the hunter shoots the bear. So how does that increase the population?
Right,
and,
right.
It's kind of a simplistic view, but yep. there really is a big difference between feeding and baiting. And
right.
Feeding, for one thing, is duration. Right. Baiting is only allowed during a short period.
All right. Well, Randy, thank you for being on our show. We really appreciate it. And all of our listeners, thank you for tuning in tonight to The Maine Outdoors.
Thank you, Greg.